listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Peter Laveau, the host of RT's flagship program Crosstalk, about President Donald Trump's recent announcement that U.S. troops will withdraw from Syria, and speculation that he will be withdrawing from Afghanistan and Iraq at some time in the near future. Peter, Happy New Year, first of all, and it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, you're the first person broadcast-wise that I talked to this year. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. I guess we could start in Syria, or in Washington talking about Syria, or in the U.S. media talking about Syria, or any one of the above.
Well, it's quite interesting. We can say many things about Donald Trump, and we have. I think a lot of criticism of him and his administration is valid, but he is on the right side of history on this one. This is a no-brainer. Getting out of Afghanistan, getting out of Iraq, and specifically right now getting out of Syria, where the United States is there illegally. It was not invited there. It's not there under the auspices of the United Nations Security Council. It is there illegally, conducting a war illegally for no particular reason other than to be there. The administration has changed their position repeatedly over the last 2 years why the United States is in Syria, and not up until Trump's tweet declaration. It was to stay there to make sure that ISIS didn't come back and to make sure Iran didn't increase its quote-unquote influence in Syria. So it's been mission creep all along. It has no strategic value whatsoever, and this is an impediment to ending the civil war that the West, for the most part, and its Gulf allies have pursued. And now it is time to wrap it up. Russia is front and center, though you won't hear this in the mainstream media, right, to come to a diplomatic solution, because Russia is the country that will have to deal with Turkey, and the Turks and the Russians with their ups and downs, can come to some kind of conclusion where Syria remains whole and it has a government of the people. And Russia has been working very, very hard, though. Again, you wouldn't hear this in the mainstream media, where there'll be constitutional and political reform in Syria. Those are all positives. And so Donald Trump is on the right side of history. I've been watching the media. None of these people really know it. They don't know anything at all about what they're talking about. Empire is going to be America's demise. Though they all have a stake in empire, that's why they cannot pull back from it, from the both political parties to the media to the military industrial complex. Even Hollywood has a stake in empire, and it is not paying. It is unaffordable. It is immoral, and for the most part, it's illegal. Donald Trump is doing the right thing, though he's paying a pretty high political cost. There may even be an attempt to impeach him over his strategic thinking when it comes to U.S. overseas commitments. It will change from Russiagate to he's a national security risk. Why not? They've tried everything else.
I mean, they've been selling. You know, the press has been acting shocked, and they're talking about him being intemperate because of the timing of it, quote unquote. But I was in the RNC in Cleveland when he said it was time to put an end to the failed policies of nation building and regime change. And nation building, quote unquote, is the official mission in Iraq and Afghanistan for better than a decade now. I mean, the regime change already took place. And the regime change is what the purpose, regardless of what, you know, niceties they've spewed out of Washington, what was driving the Syria war. And so, you know, now he is, and he says while he's doing these things, you know, these were campaign promises. I was elected to do this, and that's something to remember. I mean, there is this huge political cost because he's getting bashed everywhere for doing it, but people voted for him to do this too, and he won the election. So there's a constituency there, but you would never know that looking at the media here.
Well, you know, it's really remarkable. It's common sense. If it hasn't worked, and I'm speaking about Afghanistan, for 17 years, why do you think it's going to work in the next 6 months? Come on, it really demands a total reassessment here. And this whole jargon, the adults in the room. No, it's the adults in the room that got us into this mess in the first place. And, you know, Ms. Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis is somehow now a saint. Well, no, he is the epitome of the global war on terror, which, you know, is a euphemism for empire. And it's an utter, complete failure. It's time to rethink this. And it will actually strengthen the United States. You know, I don't know how many of your listeners, you know, travel much around the world, but the reputation of the United States is in tatters in so many places. And it's not just because of Donald Trump. It is this flagrant abuse of power, the flagrant abuse of international law. I mean, it's even in Europe, most people see this now. They don't have a stomach for these sanctions against Russia anymore. Look at Merkel's position now. I mean, obviously, it was the immigration issue that hurt her the most, but also it's her position vis-a-vis Russia that hasn't helped her at all, because there is a very important part of her constituency, industrialists, that have lost money year after year over these sanctions, which do not make any sense at all. The Europeans do not feel threatened by Russia. The Europeans don't care about Crimea. Why do people in the swamp in Washington, you know, force the Europeans to do things against their own national material interest? The Europeans have had enough.
Yeah, you know, and by the way, when you talk about the Europeans and their attitudes towards Trump, you know, it's the same, I guess, dichotomy that you face when you talk about Americans. For example, Macron, you know, those kind of people in Europe, those Europeans, quote unquote, will say the same thing that the Western press says about Trump and about Brexit. And about all of the other phenomenon that are showing a rejection of the existing order across the board, particularly of austerity, of all of the problems that people have faced that are consequent to these wars, including, you know, massive migration into these countries and overburdening of all of the systems, etc. There's the whole officialdom, the media, everyone else is parroting the same line that the media parrots here, but the people on the ground vote for Brexit. You know, they're
yellow vests.
Yeah, the yellow vests in the streets now, ready to, you know, show Macron a 21st century version of a guillotine. You've had, you want to start with Syriza and run through, you know, the gamut of things, even at left and right. Phenomenon, you know, with people mouthing leftist rhetoric on the one hand or rightist rhetoric on the other, if they're talking about addressing both the question of national sovereignty, because no one feels that their institutions respond to them, getting them jobs, helping them pay to live, those things resonate no matter whose mouth they come out of at the moment, because the condition of people is so desperate. And those folks that are informed about what's going on, well, they'll tell you that the people that voted for Brexit are the same, that that's the same phenomenon that's got Trump elected. Well, they did vote for Brexit, and they voted for all these other things that are also being pointed to as the same phenomenon as Trump, because those people face the same conditions that workers in the United States face.
You know, politics is the art of the possible. But what we have now in Washington, in London, in European capitals, is that we have this neoliberal ideology, and this is politics in the service of an ideology. These people are that are in power have no idea how the rest of us live. They don't.
Yeah.
And it's coming to the these protests are manifestations of people believe the system doesn't work for them. I mean, for God's sake, Macron wanted to have a fuel tax because of the danger of global warming. So the poor people should pay for it when he gets tax cuts to the rich.
That's right.
I mean, that's not hard to figure out. It's not hard.
Yeah.
And well, in France, it wasn't the National Front or what was called the National Front. They didn't push this. They grabbed onto it. The unions didn't push this. They grabbed onto it. I mean, this is an amazing moment here. And it's being duplicated around the world. I even came across in Hong Kong. They started donning yellow vests.
Yep.
Well, people see the system doesn't work for them. This is a system driven by ideology and not by the needs of the public, of the electorate. And that's what we're told is what democracy is all about.
That's right. You go back 7.5 years to when, you know, you had the first Occupy Wall Street group occupied that little park, Zuccotti Park in New York, and inside of 2 weeks, there were hundreds of them across the world. Why did that happen? It wasn't such a brilliant idea. It wasn't because it was reproduced, you know, in the mass media or whatever. It was because the conditions were, for the same reason that if you light a match in California after a drought, the state catches fire. Because the conditions, the objective conditions, are waiting for exactly that. People are desperate. When you say, here's food, if they're hungry, they come to eat it. They don't ask you what your political ideology is. They don't ask you what religion your third cousin is or how you feel about abortion or whatever. They're like, where's the food? And they go eat.
Yeah, see, this is the problem with the Western paradigm is that And you can speak to it better from the U.S., but in general, you get this identity politics, which for me is a switch and bait game all of the time. See, I come from this from a very strong, confirmed conservative, but I can understand progressives extremely well. But what bothers me on the left is that the left will divide everyone. I mean, look at the 2020 election coming up. I mean, should white men apply? Joe Biden, is he too old and too white? See, you go down that same path each time. Switch and bait. No, what about a politician that can create a coalition to start standing up for working people of the United States? That is a simple proposition. But in democratic politics in the U.S. today, that is not possible. And that's what keeps the centrist, neoliberal centrist in power. And there has to be a way to break out of that because it's a process of a self-fulfilling failure over and over again. I watch these things, MSNBC, I mean, you know, keep going, morning joke and meager. You're going to elect another Donald Trump. Because they don't talk to people. Why do you think most people don't watch that program? Because they don't speak to viewers. They speak to their little tiny niche.
Right.
And they're oblivious to the rest of the world, particularly of the American public. I mean, it's no surprise that Tucker Carlson has probably the most popular program on television, on cable, because he talks to people about everyday problems that they face. You know, most people don't give a rat's ass about Russiagate at all. I know people just tune it out.
The polling
data shows
that.
It means everything to the political class.
Yeah. Well, they keep, you know, that they keep repeating it. And that's the main agenda for the new House of Representatives, you know, the Democratic majority in the House. You know, the agenda is not, okay, how can we make more jobs for people than Trump does so that we can win the 2020 election based on our program got more of you people jobs than what he said. Instead, it's about, okay, let's get the tax returns and the files and start getting ready for more of that. How many more Russians can we arrest and accuse of this, that, or the other nefarious actions? And they're doubling down on the same thing that polling data says people don't care about. I mean, you have the discussion about who should be the Democratic nominee being over Biden because he's old, white, and male, say Kamala Harris because she's not those, when they have the same policies, and the policies are offensive to the interests of most of the people that are having the conversation and that are going to vote, but no conversation about, well, what policies would be better for those people that might draw people in on that basis, completely off the chart. Instead, they're talking about what color Biden is or what color Kamala Harris is.
Well, that you know, the Democratic Party doesn't want me in their party, obviously. I'm not wanted there, so I'm not going to entertain them whatsoever. I'm, by definition, by my appearance and my genetic code, I'm no longer welcome there. I know that. Okay, fine. Let's go back to the Syria thing, because I think it's really important.
Yeah.
Polls show, let me introduce this a little bit better. Okay, think of all of the cable, you know, including Fox, you know, Hannity and Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson, and then CNN, MSNBC. Trump is committing treason by getting out of Syria. Okay, then the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and all the think tanks. You know, Trump is traitorous. Public opinion, narrowly, but in a majority, are for the pullouts.
Right.
What does that tell us? Even when the entire propaganda machine is at full throttle, greased up, the American public, by a majority, slim majority, think it's a good idea. Isn't that extraordinary? After this day after day after day of this message coming out that Trump is traitorous, the majority of the public polled say, no, he's not. That is an extraordinary finding.
This is one of the things with Professor Montero that I've observed. You know, coming into this, Trump had supposedly an approval rating, depending on which polling, you know, company it was, which is, this is also pretty interesting, but from between 38% positive to, say, 50% positive. Now, there's been a massive wall-to-wall media barrage attacking him for, you know, pulling out, this guy sat behind him in kindergarten and he used to pass wind, that kind of stuff, every corner of his life being laid out. And his polling data has actually increased slightly in the face of all of that, which tells you something about the limits of the, you know, the kind of soft power that they've been throwing at him using the media and these other devices.
Absolutely. And I think we've mentioned this before on your program. It was a few months after the 2016 election. I'm trying to remember where I read it. I think it might have been in the American Conservative. But the research, I don't think it's definitive yet, but I think at the time, it showed that some of the congressional districts that were tipped in Trump's favor were people that had family members, current or former members of the military. And the military has had enough of these wars.
Yep.
Enough is enough. And Trump's anti-war, anti-nation building rhetoric was appealing to them. And I think we're seeing it again in the polls. Yeah. And I'm very frustrated. Now, look, you know, I hate that I have to always say this. You know, I am neither for or against Trump. For me, it's immaterial. I'm more interested in policy. From a conservative side, you're more on the progressive side. But we're having this conversation right now, right. Okay? Right. Because it's not happening in America.
That's right.
Right.
I mean, look, you could go from Fox to Democracy Now, and you're going to hear pretty much the same views being, you know, symbolically perhaps they'll be represented differently. But in the essence of it is, in one group, Trump is treasonous for withdrawing from Syria, and he's abandoning the Kurds and all of that. I would say maybe, you know, Fox and CNN, MSNBC, that's what they're saying. Say Democracy Now! would say, or some of the others in the progressive media, I'm thinking like Truth Out and these others. Well, you know, the policy is probably not a bad idea if it were done right, but Trump's motives for it are no good because he's, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the fact that he's a narcissist and all these other things factor into a discussion of should we stop illegally murdering people in Syria? Like, that doesn't enter the conversation at all. First of all, that it's illegal for us to be there. Secondly, that whole war really is, in essence, is a project of the United States government, starting with the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, that was intended for geopolitical purposes there to further isolate Iran, to, you know, help pave the route into Russia and China through that neighborhood. None of that stuff. And the trillions of dollars that have been wasted there are discussed in the media here at all.
Why are these armchair generals in the media? Why are they so concerned with the Kurds all of a sudden? They don't care about Palestinians, right. Obviously. Okay, they right. don't. All right.
Yemenis. Well, but now
if you actually follow the story from people that know what they're talking about, like Moon of Alabama and some of the writings at antiwar.com, The Kurds are, for the most part, have never had a conflict with the government in Damascus. Now they're given a reason to sit down with Damascus. Like I said earlier, there's constitutional reform being worked on. The Kurds will have a rightful place inside of Syria. They will not get statehood. No, they won't. Will they be protected? Yes. Right. And it's because during this entire conflict that the Kurds have never seriously opposed, fought the Damascus government, a compromise can be found there through the good offices of Moscow. And I bet you my bottom dollar, they're talking about that right now. See, if Russia, the Kurds, and Damascus can work out a framework, Erdogan will make some kind of bluster, rhetorical statements, and then he too will come down and make a negotiated deal. And on top of it, because the Saudis do not want to see a major victory for the Turks in the region, the Saudis will turn off the money, turn off the support, and try to be on the winning side, make amends with Damascus. For God's sake, MBS has enough problems right now. The Iranians, they want to have a friendly neighbor. Who doesn't? Okay, Iranian influence, maniacal, malignant, and all this in Syria. It's nonsense.
Right.
They've had some advisors there about destroying ISIS after all this time. Trump defeated ISIS. Nonsense. The Russians did in 6 weeks with 30 planes.
Right.
And what has the United States been doing during its illegal occupation with its 8 airfields? What has it been doing other than sucking its thumb?
Yep.
What did they do against ISIS? 30 planes in 6 weeks. That's all it took.
Right.
Americans never wanted to destroy ISIS. Look, never.
I think the main thing that Trump did in terms of defeating ISIS was call down to Langley and say, no more payroll. No, they just stopped paying them.
Yeah, because during this entire Western-made, Western-sponsored international proxy war,
right.
Believe it or not, you had the Pentagon and the CIA funding different groups
shooting
to fight each other.
That's right. They were shooting at each other, basically, on the ground.
Yes.
Yep.
So, you know, all of these people from Democracy Now! All the way to Fox, they don't have a clue about what they're talking about
at all.
I mean, actually, if you really want to be logical about it, why shouldn't the United States want the Russians and the Iranians in Damascus to fight ISIS instead of the United States?
Right.
So why not? And of course, a lot of it has to do with Israel. Oh, Mike Pompeo has to fly to Tel Aviv to say, we're going to continue to give you billions of dollars to protect you from the Syrians, which you, the United States has no strategic interest in at all, zero. Israel's role in this conflict has been maniacal. What they've tried to do is stir it up as much as possible, as long as possible. A destabilized Syria with black flags is fine with the Israelis because they know the Americans will be there to put treasure and blood into a conflict that has no strategic influence or value to the United States whatsoever.
Yeah, actually, to the contrary, because when you started seeing ISIS explosions, quote unquote, around Europe and the threat of it and even copycats in the United States, that's negative for the United States, and that's a direct consequence of their involvement with ISIS in the first place.
Okay, let's look at Afghanistan. If we don't defeat them there, they'll come and fight us at home.
Right.
Well, the Taliban has never had any interest of fighting external foes, ever.
Right.
That's ever.
Right.
They don't want foreigners occupying their country.
Right. That's all.
Okay. And, you know, even after the horrific experience the Soviet Union / Russia had with Afghanistan, they have a very strong interest to make sure that Afghans take care of themselves. They're there with their good diplomatic offices as usual.
Yep.
Now, the United States, they can leave. There'll be other players to work out an arrangement. So all of this stuff you hear in Western media is just utter nonsense. These are people that they cannot marshal facts and logic.
Well, look at, you know, again, they talk about Trump decided, like he's flipped on a dime to pull out of Iraq, of Syria.
No,
understood. No, exactly. Here's what I wanted to say. That's what they say in the media here. You know, 2 days before this, there's a huge meeting at the Security Council discussing the week before that, the Astana Group meetings, where these agreements were reached. Well, we're going to tweet that Astana Group, by the way, being Turkey and Iran, with guarantorship by Russia of the outcome, and in consultation with, you know, behind the scenes or soft consultation, but with an eye towards recognizing the sovereignty of Syria. And that basically a post-war arrangement for the governance of Syria, the independent governance of Syria, was agreed on by, the most important part, both Turkey and Iran. That agreement being reached, then there's a discussion of it at the UN Security Council, and then Trump says, okay, mission accomplished, we're pulling out. And everybody looks at Trump's announcement completely out of that context.
Well, look, the Astana process is fraught with difficulties. I saw the communique that came out with the Iranians and the Turks and the Russians, and it's they ironed over a lot of things. It's going to be very hard because more than anything else, Erdogan doesn't want to lose face.
Right.
And there has to be a way to mitigate that. I mean, I think Erdogan is a pretty erratic leader, but they have the building blocks for this. The U.S. getting out the U.S. getting out forces Erdogan's hand, which is really good because he's been saying for weeks, I'm going to move invade further and further. I'm going to take on the Kurds. And now Trump took the wind out of his sails.
Right.
Now he has to say, uh-oh, because is he going to really do it?
Right, which moves, then all of a sudden you hear that the Kurds, quote-unquote, we're talking about the YPG and the PKK, they're making an accommodation with the government, and they're saying to Damascus government, come on in and take the place of the Americans and just guarantee us against an invasion from Turkey or anybody else. That is the outcome that the government wanted anyway, that, you know, we want our territory back.
Exactly. And with the U.S., as if we think of it in terms of a chessboard, the American piece is taken off the board. It actually gives an initiative for all the remaining parties to move forward, because no one is going to get everything they want, but everyone can get something now.
Yeah.
Because you have the U.S. there on mission creep looking for a reason to stay. That was a wild card. Now that card, we hope, fingers crossed, that has been played. And now the other players can have a strategy forward. And no one, with the U.S. out of the picture, ISIS and its affiliated groups, they don't really have a sponsor anymore. Like I said, the Saudis and the Emirates, they're going to say, we don't want Turkey to have a strategic win here. I mean, because of the Khashoggi affair and all of this, the Saudis are furious. Right. And now they see Erdogan waltzing into Syria. Everything MBS has done vis-a-vis Syria has been a catastrophe. Now he has a chance to tacitly, and hopefully more than tacitly, support the Damascus government with this new peace process that's possible. See, that's where that's the bazaar of the Middle East, okay? The armchair generals in the U.S. don't understand the region. You rent loyalty. You can't buy it. Yeah. And at the end of the day, this is a region that has to find a way to work itself out. The U.S. and the Western powers have always made that impossible. We go all the way back to the breakup of the Ottoman Empire to the present. And now the Iraq, you know, since democracy was brought or bombed to Iraq, the Iraqis are saying the Americans must leave.
That's right.
OK,
that's right.
They must listen to the democratic will of the Iraqi people. Get out of their country. And I think it's all possible. Get out of Afghanistan. Get out of Iraq. Get out of Syria. Stop supporting the Saudis in Yemen. You know, these are all positive things that make the region safer and does not in any way, shape, or form weaken the United States. The United States has got its fingers in so many pies in the Middle East that they work at cross purposes, like we just mentioned.
That's right.
The Pentagon's guys are fighting the CIA's
guys.
That's right,
and all on our dime. And hopefully that situation is about to change. Peter, thank you very much. We look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Look forward to it, too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie and Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. 40 years on, the groundbreaking music of Pink Floyd still sounds fresh, and the lyrics of Roger Waters are as relevant as ever. How hard is the balancing act between music and politics? Well, I'm here in St. Petersburg to ask the legend himself, Roger Waters, musician, author, activist, co-founder of Pink Floyd, and my guest today. It's really great to have you with us today. Welcome to Russia.
Thank you.
Everyone's really happy that you're here, looking forward for your tour, and I'm looking forward for a little chat. So I'm going to start from the eternal question, because you've been pushing the boundaries of music forever. At the same time, the lyrics that you write are always very powerful. So the big question is, what is more powerful, the word or the music?
The way that I work, they have equal importance. I mean, the trick with songs, and I'm never quite sure where it comes from, but it's to do with the way the feelings that are in the lyric of the songs and the ideas that are in the lyrics of the song somehow get kicked into a more accessible place by having to relate to the meter of the music. I don't know, it's a kind of magical thing. I feel a bit like I'm kind of pulling the wings off a butterfly even to talk about it, because it's sort of mysterious. You know, writing song, it's a sort of a mystery, how it happens or why it happens, where the connections are made between the heart and the soul and the brain and the intellect and the nature of if one is intellectually inquisitive about the world that one lives in and so on and so forth. It's just a way of, being alive.
You get this question a lot in different forms, but I never really quite grasped an answer. For instance, if you go to a Paul McCartney concert, who's a great musician and a friend of yours, from what I gather, you forget about Syria and sanctions for one night. And you have that little space of 3 hours to think about love or heartbreak or, I don't know, family, friendship. You would never be okay with giving your audience or people just that. What is it about? Does music always have to be fused with a certain message, or else it makes less sense and it's not as important?
No, there's no has to or doesn't have to or anything. My father was dead, so I never really knew him at all. But my mother gave me a great gift when I was a child, and that was, she said that the only thing that was fundamentally important to her was to care for other human beings, to empathize with others. So, for instance, she was a school teacher. She had my brother and I to bring up on her own, and she was very political. So if she would go to a political meeting, often in the evening, she'd drag us along with her, and we'd sit there, and the British China Friendship Association or something. I'm saying this is specific. And we would watch grainy movies about the heroic struggle of the China, you know, of Mao and the Long March and the Chinese peoples fighting against the Japanese and the puppet government and blah. But often the meetings in Cambridge, where I brought up, would be in the Friends Meeting House, which is the home of the Quakers, you know, who are a religious sect. I'll never forget, my mum said to me one day when we were leaving, she said, "You know where we are, you know?" And I said, yeah. Well, I didn't really. It's called the Friends Meeting House, right? It's the Quakers. It's a Christian sect. And she said, "As you know, I'm an atheist, so I cannot subscribe to their religious beliefs, but they are very, very good people." Mm. And I thought, wow, how cool is that? Now, I can hear her saying it now.
So I guess you're very much like your mother, from what you described right now.
I have her hands.
Well, I mean, and you're very outspoken, and you always say what you think, and you're very adamant to get your message through, and you've been political throughout all your life, from day one of your career. But people now are saying, you know, maybe water should just stick to music. They never really said it before, and I wonder why it has become so pervasive now. Has your message changed? Has it become more acute? Why are they all of a sudden realizing that Roger Waters, along with great music, is
because
political?
They're sleepwalking, because they're asleep, because they are the victims of the neoliberalism that, you know, that Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher brought to the world, and that has spread all pervasively, certainly through Western culture and Western politics and things. And it, part of the way that it works is to anesthetize people and almost to make it uncomfortable for people to hear anything real. You know, this is so it's difficult for some people. And I get people. I mean, in America, we'd get people walking out of the shows. Not many, maybe 4 or 5 out of 20,000, you know. But nevertheless, if you're, why doesn't he just shut up and play the music, you know? And I sometimes speak to them, because I speak to the audience most places that I play now. And sometimes I'm a bit playful.
How ready are they to hear that? Because most of them are like, they're just to trip and breathe, for instance, right? And then you're speaking to them. Like, you're really trying to get them out of their comfort zone.
Unfortunately, we don't educate ourselves or our children well enough. And the reason we don't do that is, in America, I live in the United States of America. In the United States of America, they spend nothing on public education. And the reason is, in my view, I'm always ready to be wrong about everything. They want to keep the electorate ignorant and mindless and unthinking and malleable and pliable and very open to the use of consumerism and propaganda to keep them under control, to maintain, you know, the Orwellian notion of the sheep and the whatever and whatever, whatever.
Actually, so that's why. I'm going to get to the Western mainstream because I really want to hear your views on that. But a little bit about you before we get to the bigger things. When Iraq war was taking place, you said that your songs from the wall were as relevant as ever. And now you're on tour. The tour is called Us Plus Them. That's a song from the dark side. And obviously you feel like it's relevant today. But, you know, what hasn't really changed in the last 40 years? I mean, no iPhone 135,000 will ever change the fact from what we see that people who are killing each other for religion or oil or gas or money are they still continuing to doing today as if they're doing like 2,000 years ago. Does it like discourage you, demoralize you? What keeps you driving? Because you've been out there for 40 years and all your songs were relevant then and relevant now, but things don't really change.
Well, that's true. But we have to remember that 40 years is sort of irrelevant in terms of the history of Homo sapiens and also in terms of thought and in terms of the way things develop and the potential that we have to change systems. For, you know, first of all, you really have to go back to say, well, I'm glad that I was born after the Enlightenment, if you like, you know. I'm glad the French Revolution happened a couple of hundred years ago so that we can have the Déclaration des Droits de l'Homme is in our back pocket if we want it. I agree with that. That is a good thing. This is something that I can cling to. But and then that puts us then somewhere different than the people who would suggest that I shouldn't be political at rock and roll shows. What are you talking about? What shouldn't be? It's none of your business. And you can not come or you can come, but you can't influence me with an opinion about something like, it's not your music, it's my music. It's not your job. It's my life. This is what I do, and it's what I've always done. If you thought you were a fan of Pink Floyd and you didn't notice that that's what I did when I was running Pink Floyd, you're an idiot. You know? But I don't want to hear. Life is too short for me to listen to idiots. I'm not interested in their opinions. I'm interested in the opinions of people who are thoughtful or caring or something or have something about them that there are certain people that you meet and you talk to and it's like reading a great book.
Let's talk about you and what you believe in, or you're very outspoken about. You're an avid supporter of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. You urge colleagues to follow suit. Latest example, Lana Del Rey. There is no question that when you say things, you believe in them and you take full responsibility for it. But how fair is it to actually, you know, shame some of your colleagues into not going to Israel or you know, pressure them to think like you if they don't? Because you are your own person and you're completely entitled to thinking that.
But okay. My alternative is to say nothing. I can't say no. When civil society in Palestine has reached out to the rest of global civil society, which it did in 2004, and specifically the PACBL, right, the cultural boycott thing, they specifically reached out to artists and cultural figures and academics in the rest of the world and said, we are dying. We're dying here. We're dying. Please help us. Please do not go and to Israel and perform. If they offer you an academic accolade or award, please refuse it. This is the only way we can think of now after the two intifadas.
How does that make Israel's government change their mind?
Well, look what they're doing now. They're trying now to make BDS illegal in the United States and in France and in Germany. And to some extent, that because BDS has shone the light on what they are actually doing. But they don't seem to be learning anything from it at the moment. But they are swaying public opinion all over the world now by killing those 150 kids in the Great March, the return home, the protests near the fence that's round the prison. People are appalled by that because it's almost impossible not to be. If you see it, you have to see it. BDS helps people see it. I help people see it. I pass on as much of it as I can, always, because it's so important to me.
Still, there's another side to the story, and that's just regular Israelis. Some of them still come to your show. They haven't even voted for Netanyahu. They're not for settlements. How fair is it to punish them?
People tell me that, unfortunately still, it's a huge majority of Israeli Jews believe that the policies in relation to Gaza and in relation to the settlements and in relation to building permits and are fine. They don't see a problem with it. This is a big, big majority of Israelis. Maybe not Israeli Arabs, but they're only 20% of the population. So that 80% of the 80%, there is a resistance. And I know many of them. They're friends of mine, you know. But it's not huge numbers.
We're going to take a short break right now, and when we're back, we'll continue talking to Roger Waters, a legendary musician, activist, co-founder of Pink Floyd. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Roger Waters. Roger, your strong opinions about other things. I know that the White Helmets, at some point they asked you for your help, and you're like, no, because you're a weird organization.
The White Helmets approached me twice. Once was for a fundraiser in London, organized by the Syria campaign. Okay, and I looked in it, and I thought, there's something... Who are these people? And so I did a fair bit of research.
What is it that you see in that organization that the Western mainstream doesn't?
Well, hang on a minute. The White Helmet?
What is it? Yeah.
Well, for instance...
Because they're obviously idolized in the West.
For instance. Well, okay. I'll tell you. Just a couple of things. We could be here all day talking about the White Helmets because that is a very deep rabbit hole. For a start... There is no evidence to support the idea that it's a grassroots organization in rebel-held territories in Syria that grew up from people who just wanted to go and help civilians get out of bomb buildings. No evidence to support that. So that's one thing. When I made my speech, I gave a little speech in Barcelona, because the other thing is a French guy who supports the White Helmets, he goes around the world climbing tall buildings wearing a white helmet. And he said, I want to come on stage and give a message to the children of Syria. We haven't forgotten you. Can I come? And I went, no, you can't come on stage and say that. I mean, I'm sure he's sincere and and whatever. But I explained why. This happened, my gig was on April the 14th this year. This year, in Barcelona. On April the 7th, it is alleged there was a chemical attack in Douma, in Syria, and a video appeared with people hosing down children, kids with masks on their faces, and blah, 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 and all of that, made by White Helmets. And the White Helmets sent this video, and it went viral, blah, blah, blah. On the evidence of that video, the governments of the United States of America, the UK and the Republic of France all decided to go and bomb Syria. And just on the basis of that, I stood up on stage and said, I think I have this, I think it would be huge error to go and bomb airfields in Syria until we know what happened. The United States and the UK and France did send 100 cruise missiles into Syria. I don't think they did much damage. Thank goodness they didn't kill people. But they did do that, and they did. And then the people left, and the next day, two journalists went in. Robert Fisk, who worked for The Independent, which is a perfectly reputable English news broadsheet. Well, it's tabloid, actually, but... And also a strange journalist. He was working for a conservative Christian TV station from Texas, and his name was Pearson Sharp. And they both extensively went all over Doom. They both went to the hospital where the video had been shot, and everybody told them the same story. Absolutely nobody knew anything about any chemical attack. The doctors said there was no chemical attack. We had a few people in who'd got dust in their throats. There was not a single death in Douma that day. Nobody. Nobody was killed. Certainly nobody was affected by chemicals of any kind. And so there's these two independent journalists in there and sending out these reports that were unequivocal. And I believe them to be true. Funnily enough, the official, you know, chemical weapons inspectors went in 4 or 5 weeks later with all their stuff, and their report came out, and they said they couldn't find a single trace of any nerve agent. They found chlorinated something, I can't remember how it was phrased, which could be a bag of salt, could be anything, you know, but so they did not, so they... The official report is now out. Nobody read it. It wasn't news. You couldn't see it on CNN because it's not the narrative that they follow. Their narrative is that there was a chemical attack and the white helmets are wonderful. I just have to say this one more thing because I said this in Oslo and I will say it whenever this comes up. If there is a grassroots body called the White Helmets of volunteers, separate for the people who actually it started in Istanbul. It didn't start in Syria. It was started by an English soldier in Istanbul. But if that body exists, and they go and help people after, you know, either Assad or the Russians or somebody else has dropped bombs on them, then I support them wholeheartedly with every fiber of my being. But all the evidence points to the fact that that is not the reality. I don't know if you... Did you see the documentary that won the Oscar?
Yes, I have.
I mean, have you ever seen anything so obviously scripted and carefully shot and put together? Did that look like a documentary that's come out of a war-torn?
That's another thing I want to talk to you about. You're saying carefully scripted. You used it is not their narrative. That's why the report from the inspectors is not making the mainstream media in the United States. Yeah. When you say, like, you know, I'm critical of U.S. airstrikes over Syria, or you say, you know, I believe after looking into it that the White Helmets are a shady organization from what I've gathered, or like Skripal case is, sorry, strange. Then they say right away that you are a Putin sympathizer, that you're aligned with the Russian authorities.
Of course they do.
I'm sure if you weren't who you are, they would just say you're outright nuts.
Do you think I won't be attacked for being on RT?
But why is it? Why is it someone? I don't even know if you like Putin or not, but why is it that someone that doesn't express an opinion that's in line with the State Department is like scarlet lettered, like branded like a Russian spy or like a Kremlin sympathizer, because, as if like you can't think for yourself?
Well, I mean, clearly the warmongers are doing it because they want to promote the idea of having war with Iran first and maybe Russia second. There's a lot of money in war. And I know this sounds like crazy conspiracy theory stuff, but it's not. Why are they spending $600 billion a year going into foreign countries that are none of their business and killing brown people and Muslims? Why? What's it for? You know, if you start asking those people, why are you doing this? Is it because you're scared because they're going to attack you because they hate your freedom? I mean, the narrative is nonsensical in every possible way. The U.S. narrative. Yeah, and they'll probably throw me out eventually of the country.
You think so?
I've no idea. I've no idea.
Do you feel that danger? Or
I feel that people are trying to silence me. I mean, obviously on the BDS issue, they've been trying to silence me. They threaten me as well.
Where would you go?
Well,
back to Britain?
Oh, what you mean if I didn't live in the United States? I don't know. No, I wouldn't go back to the UK, I don't think.
Would you come to
Maybe
Russia?
Maybe Portugal.
Why not Russia?
Well, why Russia?
Because it's a great country.
maybe you're right. I've no idea.
Can I ask you another thing? Have you noticed the general line and the leeway also that the American officials allow themselves to have when it comes to speaking about the Russians? I mean, I've just heard this American politician say Russians are genetically driven to co-opt and penetrate. That's a quote. And I was thinking, oh my God, like if any of the Americans, special officials, were caught saying that about Jews or the African Americans, that would be like the end of their career.
Yeah.
Why is it okay and why is it allowed to speak about Russians like that to people?
Well, because the mainstream media in the United States of America have been selling this narrative to the general public for the last, I don't know, 4 years, I think it goes back. How long do you think it goes back? I would say about 4 years.
I think it started during Obama period. It became really bad during the presidential campaign, and it's gotten even worse ever since Trump is in office.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, I've had, when I was making this record I just made, Is This the Life We Really Want?, the guy who was producing this record with me started telling me about how RT was just pure propaganda, nothing but a pack of lies. Well, I watch RT. So I've said, you can't see a documentary about fracking on American television because they're not interested in telling you anything about anything. You know, it's so obvious now that CNN and all the American, all of them, they're all the same, MSNBC or to Fox and everything in between, maybe not Discovery, no. Maybe that's the one little piece of TV in the United States where you can occasionally get a glimpse of the reality of what it's like to be human. But the rest of it is just propaganda. I still don't know, though, why it is. The whole Russia thing. I've said this to audiences as well. I say to them sometimes in, you know, other countries. Well, in America, I said, have you any idea who the Russians are? Have you ever met a Russian person? I said, because I've met many Russians, and I'm not saying I know many Russians very well, but I do know this. The Russian people gave up 20 million lives in the Second World War to save you from the Nazis. And you want to go around with a stick and poke at them? Are you insane? You have no idea what you're talking about. And also, you know nothing about the country or the people or whatever. It's just finger pointing.
Why won't you run for office?
Because I have important things to do in my life.
Well, okay. Along those important things, thanks a lot for talking to us. And stay tuned on RT, okay? Because I like you watching us.
I will.
Okay. Good luck with everything.
Hey, thank you so much.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.